Welcome to Lyme and Beyond with Tanya. And I'm excited to have our next guest join us. Of course, we're going to hear his amazing Lyme journey, all the normal stuff we talk about. But I want you to be sure to listen in till the end because he's going to talk about something called lateral eye movement. I don't even know what this is, but I'm excited to learn. He's actually going to walk us through a technique that he learned along his journey to help us sleep. And if you have dealt with Lyme for, I don't know, even a week, you know sleep is an issue. So I'm super excited to hear what he's going to share with us later on. And I'm just excited to have him here and to hear his Lyme journey. So welcome, Nathan. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Tanya. It's good to be here.
Awesome. So where do we start? How far back do we go? Do you remember? Do you know how it started?
Yeah, it was about 5.5 years ago. I was on vacation at Bear Lake in Idaho, border of Utah and Idaho, with my family. And when I returned from the lake, I just developed a huge rash on my right arm. And it wasn't a bullseye-shaped rash, however. Now, I grew up in Virginia. I was aware of Lyme disease, but I always had this notion in my mind that if I get a bullseye-shaped rash, go get antibiotics.
Yes.
Yeah. What I didn't know was that, my knowledge of this is probably slightly inaccurate, but I know there's some truth to this at least, but what I didn't know at the time is that Lyme disease doesn't always manifest a bullseye-shaped rash. In fact, I think 20% of the time there's no rash at all. Does that sound kind of correct to you?
You know, that's interesting you brought this up because I have always thought or had in my mind that less than 30% of the people actually get the bullseye rash. Yeah. But I actually was just reading something from that was published by iLads the other day, and it said less than 10% actually get the bullseye rash. So, yeah, not many, right?
Right. So yeah, it kind of flew under my radar mentally. Lyme did not pop into my head when I saw this rash. I went to the doctor, of course, and he said, it looks like a skin fungus here. And he gave me a prescription for an oral antifungal, and of course, which did nothing. And I later actually found out that there is a inexpensive, fast, and accurate skin fungus test, and I wish that had been done because that would have come up negative, you know. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that wasn't done. The other thing that is a little challenging is that I'm in a Western state. I'm in Utah. There's knowledge of Lyme disease in the medical community is not so prevalent here as it is back east.
And it's not just in Utah. So I'm not far from you. I'm just over in Idaho. And it just, you know, that's just one of the many misconceptions that people don't understand about Lyme disease is that it is in all the states. You know, yes, there are definitely states that are more prevalent with more ticks crawling. You know, I've talked to people and they're like, oh my gosh, you go outside and you just see ticks everywhere. God, I don't think I could live there. But, and you know, so obviously that doesn't happen in Utah or Idaho or, you know, some of the more Western states. I will for sure agree with that. But it really is everywhere and no one's safe from it. So.
Yeah. Well, I think the challenge with it being perhaps a little less prevalent in the Western states is that the doctors are not, they're kind of like their radar is not as alert to that happening for their patients. A lot of doctors, at least. That's my experience. And so, initially, I started accumulating all these neurological disorders. It was about maybe 45 days or so after the rash appeared that I started on a daily basis getting new neurological symptoms, about every other day, a new thing. And it started kind of cascading so quickly. I was like, gosh, I need to start tracking these. I started keeping a spreadsheet of them. And there were things like kaleidoscopic vision, for instance, where like it literally looks like you're looking through a kaleidoscope. It's just like all these like geometric color shapes and stuff. I started getting like weakness in my especially on the left side of my body, just kind of like weakness and pins and needles. I started getting a lot of like lymph pain in my lymph nodes, which I'd never had before. Just lots of weird things happening. I started getting some brain fog kind of stuff happening. And by the time I was seeing the second neurologist that I was seeing, she basically just said, you know, I was going over all this list of symptoms. I think it was just like such a list that she just looked at me and said, you need to see this other doctor. And I didn't know anything about this other doctor at the time, but he was very literate in the Lyme issue. He was a board member for on ILADS, actually. And so I went to him, and he did a gigantic battery of tests. It actually took 40 vials of blood to do all these tests.
Wow. Okay, Nathan, you have me beat. I think at one sitting, the most vials of blood that they ever took from me, I believe it was either 19 or 21, but 40. Wow. Okay, you're the winner.
I didn't actually know this at the time, but when the phlebotomist was drawing the blood, she shifted to four different sites because apparently the body is, after about 10 vials, the body's like, no more. And it'll just kind of shut down.
Just go to a different vein. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So she had to draw from four sites to get all that. But among those tests was a PCR test for Lyme, and that came up positive. So that's how we, that's when, you know, when you called me and afterwards says, it looks like you have Lyme disease. And then it sort of, that's when I look back and I was like, oh, yeah.
That's what that rash was. Yeah.
That's what the rash was. Exactly.
That's why it started. Okay. So let me just clarify for the listeners. So you went to the one neurologist and they sent you off to someone else. So it was, how long did it take you to get this diagnosis?
It was a second neurologist that sent me actually over. The first neurologist initially thought I had MS because I was manifesting symptoms similar to MS. So she did a lot, you know, I had the MRIs to look for lesions and things like that. Mm-hmm. And there were no lesions on my nerves and my brain and that. And so she said, well, it looks like you don't have MS, but I don't know what you have. And I'm sorry, what was your question then? How long?
How long from the time you started having these symptoms did you go to the doctors and then you actually got your diagnosis?
You know, it took maybe about, I started getting the symptoms in around September. I didn't get really diagnosed until the winter. So it was maybe 3 or 4 months before I actually knew, oh, I have Lyme disease. And the problem there is that, once Lyme gets entrenched, if you don't catch it early with antibiotics like doxycycline, then it can become entrenched. And it has kind of like this complex life cycle where it starts to develop cysts. Basically baby bacteria, these little nodules along the spirochete. And this is my understanding of it, at least.
Absolutely. And to be honest with you, that is one of the fastest diagnoses I've heard about. That's pretty fast, you know, because the problem where what you're just stating right there is that, you know, you get Lyme disease and it's still just a horrible disease, but if you catch it and you can get on, you know, I believe it's 6 to 8 weeks of doxycycline. Then there's a really good chance that it's just done and over with, right?
Yep.
The problem lies in that we can't get a diagnosis quick enough. So
correct.
Now everybody has chronic Lyme disease, right? And I think that just kind of goes in remission. I still believe that you absolutely can be symptom free for the rest of your life once you get to the root of the problem and you do your treatment. But I still just think it can lay dormant in there. But anyway, so you get your diagnosis, okay, and then now what happens?
So one of the first things that that doctor did is he said, hey, look, there's this drug that it's FDA approved for a different purpose, which is for treatment of alcohol. It's called disulfiram, but there's been some recent information recently that makes it look like this stuff could kill Lyme disease. And some patients have been experimenting with it off-label, I guess, you know, for treatment of Lyme disease and have been having good results from this. And then it's also apparently been shown to kill Lyme colonies in Petri. And so it's an option for you. And he was kind of laying out different things that I could try. And because I had essentially missed the window of doing doxycycline.
Yeah.
It was too late to do doxycycline. And so I'm like, okay, well, let's try the disulfiram. The problem was, by the way, obviously, guys, I'm not a doctor, so you know.
Of course, neither of us are doctors. We're just all of this podcast is always just for educational purposes only.
There you go. So I, you know, what wasn't known at the time, I don't think, was that, and maybe the state of the art of knowledge in this has changed since from what I know right now, but in the early days of using disulfiram, it wasn't known very well that you needed to enterically encapsulate the disulfiram because apparently, my understanding is that in the stomach lining, there's high amount of copper and that copper can bond with the sulfur groups in disulfiram and create these toxic, neurotoxic copper complexes. And I think my memory of it is that Jayakumar Rajadas and his team were reporting that they were found, that they were indeed finding copper neurotoxins in the brains of the rats that they were testing on. And anyway, the effect that you would have if this happened to you is that you would develop like really bad neuropathies. And there's definitely a certain percentage of the patients that experiment with disulfiram where that does happen. I don't know why this doesn't seem to happen to the like the cohort of patients for whom it was tested for alcoholism, for which it was initially developed. But my guess is, and I was kind of talking to my doctor about this, I'm like, well, you know, why would Lyme patients, why would this be happening to Lyme patients? Why would this stuff be getting into their brains? And the one theory, one idea was that, well, it looks like Lyme may make the blood-brain barrier leaky, similar to the way it may make the gut leaky. And so maybe some of these toxins are getting into the brains of Lyme patients where they might not necessarily get into the brains of someone who doesn't have Lyme. At any rate.
So it's interesting that you say this, you know, talking about how it combines with the copper in your body.
And in people
are having,
lining.
Yeah, and people are having these neuropathy problems. So what's interesting is I actually work with a light technology that uses our own body's energy to activate our own GHK copper peptide. And what I've learned along this journey is that so many of us are depleted in copper. So maybe that's why it doesn't really happen for everybody, because maybe the ones that are not affected by it are depleted on copper, right?
That's
like, I don't know. So that's kind of interesting.
I can speak to that actually a little bit because
okay.
I got tested extensively for Wilson's, for instance, and Wilson's is related to copper issues. And at least that's my memory of it. And so I had a lot of like copper related type of tests done.
Okay.
And my copper levels were effectively normal. Yet I did develop like horrific neuropathy once my dose of disulfiram got like high, and I can't remember the doses, but it was kind of like the higher end of the dose range that people were experimenting with. So the conventional wisdom at the time was go low and slow in your dosing, start out at a very low dose and gradually titrate up. What wasn't known at the time I started doing it was it would be best if you enterically encapsulate or even double enterically encapsulate the actual disulfiram, you know, put it inside enteric capsules that don't dissolve in the stomach so that it bypasses the stomach before it's actually dissolved, so that it minimizes exposure to that copper in the stomach lining.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
that's
so,
interesting.
You know, I was too early, kind of like, so I was one of the effectively.
One
know,
of the guinea pigs.
Yeah, that's medicine, though. It's practicing medicine. They're practicing. They don't really, it's not. You know, there's science to it, but there's also, you're a guinea pig. That's the hard reality.
For sure.
Yeah.
And that's, I don't know, you know, I've interviewed people in the past that have, you know, disulfiram was their ticket for sure for getting better. So it definitely works.
Yeah,
and I do know not much about it, but I know that that was kind of the deal. Low and slow, right? And it's, you kind of get up to a point, I guess they have dosages preset that they kind of want you to get up to. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I'm sorry I don't remember the exact like numbers.
Nope, and that's fine because it's probably different for everyone, right? I'm assuming so.
You should, of course, follow your doctor's recommendation on that.
Right, but I do know that, like you had mentioned previously, it was a drug made for alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
And so along listening to these people talk about their disulfiram journey, I recall hearing people saying how many things that we use on an everyday basis actually have alcohol in it, and it can interact with the drug. Did you, like, you
gotcha.
Know, like, I don't know, toothpaste negative. Or who knows,
yeah.
What I can't even recall, right? But did you have any of that, or how specific was the doctor in mentioning that to you?
That was on the radar. That was something I was conscious of, and I was careful of initially. But then I started, as I would have various things that, you know, like bread and things like that, they weren't actually problematic for me with the disulfiram. So then I started to realize, oh, okay, that's not, at least for me, that wasn't so much of an issue of like minor traces of alcohol in foods, just in normal foods, wasn't at all an issue when I was using disulfiram.
Okay, good to know.
Yeah. And I think it may have been like the thing that worked for me, but it's a little bit hard to say because I did seven things.
And we do tend to throw the kitchen sink at it, right? We want it out of our body. So you think disulfiram was kind of your ticket. Do you recall how long you actually were on the disulfiram?
Yeah, it was like roughly maybe 3 months-ish, somewhere around there.
Okay.
Yeah, and then, I had actually titrated all the way up to kind of like the maximum dose level. And I was on the actually at that maximum dose for, I think, 2 weeks when then I developed really bad neuropathy. And it felt, actually, it literally knocked me to the floor. Like, it struck in a moment. It was like someone shoved an ice pick into the back of my head. Mm. It was so excruciatingly painful, and it just collapsed. And then I went to the hospital for that, and they were, you know, doing tests. Like, and figure out what was going on, and it happened again while I was in the hospital. And so fortunately, like, those really super acute attacks only happened twice, but then I ended up having pain in my occipital lobe, that's the back region of the brain, for about 2 years after that. It was like just a constant ache.
Okay. So because of these, is that why you only did the higher dose for a couple of weeks, or is that just normal in general?
Yeah, I immediately discontinued
the disulfiram. You were done.
Because I was aware that it could cause potentially like bad neuropathy.
Okay. And so then did you switch to another form of treatment, or were you doing something in addition at the same time as the disulfiram?
No. So when I was doing the disulfiram, I wasn't that was kind of like enough, I thought. Like, I didn't want to overload my system. But after the disulfiram, I did switch and did quite a few different therapies, some of them concurrent to each other. Okay. And by the way, you know, I mentioned lymphatic pain because I was starting to experience a lot of lymphatic pain. But during, there's kind of like, during these 5 years, there's five things that I discovered. I call them my gems because they're all like really simple things, but they're like crazy effective. And the thing that like solved, like always fixed my lymphatic pain was a whole body vibration platform.
Yeah, a vibe plate, yes.
Yeah, and I would have most of the lymphatic pain kind of like up in my armpit areas and my chest, like up in here. And so what I would do is I would turn on the vibration platform and I would kneel in front of it and just kind of rest my arms on it so that at its lowest setting. And then I would just kind of let it shake my upper body, focusing on my upper body for about 10 minutes. Then I would get and just stand on it for another 10 minutes. And consistently and every single time, that always worked to just completely erase all the lymphatic pain.
That's awesome. And I'm glad you brought that up. So I too have a vibe plate at home and I think they're great. But yeah. I'm glad that you clarified. So I normally, you know, I'm healthy. I've felt amazing for, you know, over 3 years now. But I still do. Thank you. It's amazing, right?
Yes. You don't take it for granted.
No, you don't. And so we invest in a lot of modalities along our journey, right? And one of the things that I bought was a vibe plate. I'm like, I have it. I'm going to use it, right? I don't feel like I have a problem, but it's there. Get on it. And I've always only just stood on it. And so that's interesting that you said you knelt down and actually put your arms on it. So I guess that's a good thing, you know, and for the listeners out there that, you know, we understand that there's just, you know, a little bit of everything that you can invest in and buy, but a little rebounder too works, I think, can work just as well, you know, just one of those little mini trampoline things. So don't feel like you got to go out there and, you know, buy this expensive vibe plate or anything like that. So we're just throwing options out there, but that's great that that worked for you so well.
Yeah. I did try dry brushing, which is obviously a lot cheaper.
Yes.
But that was not effective for me.
And you know what? I actually heard that from another lady I was randomly chatting with a couple of weeks ago. She said that it did nothing for her. And for me, I can't even tell my experience because I have very, very sensitive skin and I have my whole life. I started doing that dry brushing and I immediately broke out in a rash. And I'm like, no, too much for me. So I don't know if it worked or not. But yes, that's also a great thing that people can do to work on their lymphatic systems at home for very inexpensive.
Yeah.
So you did that. And then what types of herbal protocols did you do?
Okay, so I did two herbal protocols and they're both like really and I did not do them at the same time, but I did do them back to back.
Okay.
And so I did first the Stephen Herod Buhner protocol. So I bought his books, first of all, so that I like knew that I was doing like the whole thing. And they are really extensive. There's a ton of herbs involved in doing it, but primarily they focus, my memory is on like cat's claw and Japanese knotweed, I think are like the main two big herbs in there.
Okay.
And, but there's a bunch of others too.
Yeah. No, and he's got a great protocol for sure.
Yeah. And by the way, I was focusing on the stuff for Babesia. Sorry, not Babesia. Lyme and Bartonella. I did not have Babesia, but I did test positive for Bartonella,
okay.
which is one of the other common co-infections of Lyme, which is Borrelia. So yes. Yeah, I had Borrelia and Bartonella.
Okay.
And I did, so I did the Stephen Hare-Buter protocol for Lyme and Bartonella. And then after that, I did the so-called Cowden protocol, which is from Nutramedics. And this is comes in a box. It's a ton of different tinctures. They're mm-hmm. they're like dropper bottles. And that went on for at least a couple months, I believe. I can't remember how long it was, but it's pretty lengthy.
Okay.
That's a lot easier to do, I found, than the Stephen Hare-Buter protocol.
And so what do you mean easier?
Just more convenient. It was just simpler for me, because gathering all those different herbs for the Buter protocol was it took a bit of research to figure out good, clean sources, organic sources for all that kind of stuff. Because that's what I was trying to get good.
Okay. Product. So the Buter protocol, he offers all of the information, and then you go find the products.
Exactly.
Okay. And then the Cowden protocol, you get the box with all the products.
Yeah. It's done for you.
Yeah. That's the easy way, right?
Any companies at all. So I'm not trying to pitch anybody.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And these are both, there's a lot of great protocols out there, and most people that are going through Lyme have heard about all of them, but that's good to know. Cause didn't know, I didn't do any of those specific protocols during my journey. So, but I can absolutely agree with you. You want to click a button and just have everything to you. Our brain doesn't work. We don't want to have to research all this stuff. Although I know that his protocols that he've lined out has been very effective for many, many people over the years. So
what you just said is really important too, because the brain not working is something that people who are going through it, they totally get this. You are messed up. And so you're at your most compromised, your least functional, and you have to deal with one of the most challenging things at that time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's really, really difficult.
To take all of these supplements. I remember I had alarms set on my phone, every 2 hours, every 4 hours, whatever it was, to take this or take that. I literally had post-it notes throughout my whole house, not only in my kitchen about, things I had to take or do or remind myself, but I would have it on the bathroom mirror, brush your teeth. I didn't even realize that that was just a natural thing we're supposed to do. Eat. Seriously, our brains just didn't work. And so to have to add in all these tinctures, it truly is like a full-time job, mm-hmm. keeping track and taking all of this stuff. It's for sure hard.
It's brutal.
Okay. So you did the Disulfiram, the Cowden protocol, the Buter protocol, and... Yeah.
Something else that was going on while this happened is that the same doctor that did those 40 vials of blood tests that got the Lyme positive test from PCR also diagnosed me with MCAS.
Okay. Which is very common. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and my understanding based on what he described is, hey, these are a certain type of immune cell that they're one of their jobs is to signal. They're a signaling cell. And one of the main signaling chemicals they make is histamine. And one of the problems with histamine, one problem with histamine is it often causes you to stay awake. And this is, so you're more likely to start having sleep disturbance, I think, if you have a lot of histamine in your system. This is why a ton of the sleep drugs out there are antihistamines.
Okay.
In nature, they're histamine blockers. So, but I could tell that I had this partly because when I would take an antihistamine, I would feel this calming sensation. There was a general feeling of agitation in my body, throughout my entire body. I almost felt like it was just buzzing with agitation.
Yeah.
And then when I would take an antihistamine, all of a sudden that would go away. So I'm like, oh, so there is something going on there. The contrast made it apparent that there was a histamine issue.
Okay. For sure, when we're going through this journey, our body's in that, what we call that fight or flight mode, right? It just always is. And I remember years ago, the doctor explaining it to me, because we, first of all, this is all new, right? I don't know anything about Lyme disease. And then my brain isn't really functioning well. So I need a little bit more explanation on different things. And I remember him explaining to me that, take, for example, your car. If you're in drive or neutral or whatever, and you rev up the engine, right? And you just never let off the gas.
Yeah.
Eventually, your car, your motor, something was going to blow up, right?
Yep.
But that is what my body was doing. Mm-hmm. It was always on full mode.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how do you ever, you know, we need to sleep at night and rest our bodies so they can rest and regenerate, right?
Don't you almost get PTSD describing this? Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
You know, I do know, I do not. And yeah, it's really good. Interesting because I wonder, you know, sometimes I have guests on and it's a very emotional journey and it can be, you know, talking about it and people get PTSD just going out and hiking and all of that. And I'm very grateful that I have never been affected in that way, talking about my journey or talking to any of the hundreds of guests that I've interviewed over the years. And I just think maybe it just because this is just what I'm supposed to be doing, right? So I don't know. So I think God just kind of left that out of me and doesn't have me affected by it. But it absolutely can be. It is a real deal for sure.
Yeah. Well, circling back to the MCAS, one of the things my doctor had me trying was a product called DHIS from Orthomolecular. It's got bromelain and zirquetin, and that actually did kind of help a little bit, but it was more like I could feel it benefiting me somewhat for a couple of hours, and then it would just taper off and not. And another thing was DAO enzyme, and I was using a product from a company called DIEM. But anyway, that stuff actually really worked great until it would wear off quickly as well, just kind of similar to the DHIS. Like it was
worked until
like
it didn't.
A temporary Band-Aid.
Okay.
But I did, and this is what I think of another, like one of my five gems, I did stumble across something that just wiped out the histamine and it never came back. And that was, I was reading some posts by some other user, some other patient who had MCAS, and he said, he's like, I found this probiotic, and this it's called, it's by, from Seeking Health, it's called Probiota Histamine X, all one word, Histamine X. And it's, what my understanding is some probiotic bacteria actually make histamine and some probiotic bacteria consume histamine. And so what you really want is a formula that's just histamine consumers if you have excess histamine. And so what this guy said is, he's like, I took 6 capsules of this a day for 2 months and my histamine issues are gone. I'm like, well, I'm desperate. I'll try anything. So I did 6. I did exactly the same thing, 6 capsules a day for 2 months. And it did exactly the same thing for me. And since that time, like, I have not had histamine issues. They're just gone.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so like this, where can people side. Get this product? Of course, yeah. We're not endorsing anything, right? We're just sharing information that worked for us.
It just
us.
Worked for me. So
is it something you get on Amazon or a specific website? Or
I've learned to be cautious about buying from third parties. I think you really want to go to the source just so that you make sure you don't get a fraudulent product. There are, I believe, sometimes products that are, you know, they're labeled, they look like the same thing.
They're not all treated equally for sure.
Yeah. Or they might, you don't know how they're actually like stored shelf, they're shelved before they're sent to you. They might just be in some hot warehouse.
Good tips. Absolutely
right. 130 degrees. And it's just destroying the value of that product. So I think it's maybe wiser to just go to the
source.
Go to the source, just get it from Seeking Health in that particular case, because they're the manufacturer of that particular
Seeking
product.
Seeking Health. Okay.
Yeah, it's a Probiota Histamine X. That's the one that worked for me. So
awesome. Hey, and you know what? There's no harm in popping 6 pills for a couple months, right? If it could change our world.
Yeah, I kind of think so too. Especially, I really like that this is a, it's like a really low risk kind of, I view it as a low risk thing with potentially great benefit.
Okay.
And of the 5 gems I found in these 5 years, 4 of them are non-drug things that are like, I view them as all really low risk with really high payoff. Like that vibration platform I told you about. Mm-hmm. It's low risk. Like, I mean, it's the most expensive of those 5 things, because a vibration platform is not a cheap device, but it's like, it's not a drug you're taking. So
yes. And that's, I'm, you know, for the listeners out there that have been following me for the last few years, they know that I don't do into this big pharma anymore. I don't do to these traditional doctors. There's a time and place. Absolutely. Yeah. I'll give them that. But, you know, they left me for dead for 7 years. And so I kind of lost, you know, a little bit of credibility in my eyes. And so, so I love, you know, anything natural that we can go with. And so that's why I love to talk about all these options out there.
I may be wrong, but so I have the same sentiment as you. And the reason I have that sentiment is because I would like always get the side effects. And I tried. I was desperate. I would try every drug the doctors would throw at me. I worked with 18 doctors over those 5 years. They threw tons of drugs at me for the various issues.
And then you need another drug because you have a side effect from that, right? Like that's
right.
That's their plan. They do it really well.
Misery. Right. So, and some of these side effects are like really brutal.
Yeah.
Like quetiapine was one of the things that I was doing. A lot of doctors prescribe that off-label for sleep issues. Quetiapine is an antipsychotic, and it's a really strong drug. And it gave me like horrific vertigo. And like they call it baby heroin because it's really hard to detox out of your system. And I experienced that. Like I had to literally crawl around my house for 2 weeks as I detoxed that out of my body with vertigo the whole time. I couldn't stand up. I didn't know until I experienced it. I did not understand really the vertigo is like a complete inability to have balance and equilibrium. It's not dizziness. You can be dizzy and still kind of stand and have equilibrium. Vertigo, nope, you can't stand.
Nope, that was... interesting you bring that up because when I initially, like you, was diagnosed with the Lyme and the Bartonella, and then, you know, I did my years of treatment, and then I had a traumatic event, a fire in my life, and then after that, I started having this really bad vertigo. And I'm like, where is this coming from? What is it? Yeah. And it's a whole nother level. Like, you know, fatigue is a whole nother level when you're talking about Lyme disease. But this vertigo, like you can't walk. Like you're holding on to the walls to try to get down the hallway.
Yeah.
And you're so dizzy that literally I would throw up. I was so sick to my stomach. Yeah. And it ended up that I had Babesia. Babesia got triggered in my body like 15 years later. It was the craziest thing. Wow. But yeah, vertigo, that whole dizzy, that is not a joke for sure.
Congratulations. You got the cofactor. Cofaction lottery winner. You got them all.
Oh my goodness.
Oh yeah. Speaking of those co-infections. So one of the problems when your immune system gets suppressed, which happens a lot of times with these chronic infections, is that like latent dormant infections like cytomegalovirus and Epstein-Barr virus and things like that rear their heads. They become activated. And that actually happened to me. So can be back to the treatment, subsequent treatments I did. One of the treatments I did was so-called supportive oligonucleotide therapy, SOT. And I did SOT therapies for four things, targeting Lyme, Bartonella, cytomegalovirus or CMV, and Epstein-Barr virus, EBV, which is mono. And it's possible that helped. But like I say, there's seven things I did. I don't know. It was kind of a shotgun approach. So I don't really know, like, okay, was it the disulfiram? Was it the
nutrient? And it could also be, you know, each one did their own thing. Possibly. They knocked it down a little bit, right? And so you needed all of these to get through it, for sure.
Yeah.
So what was your experience with the SOT? Because I do know a lot of people that go that route.
Great question. So I didn't feel any difference at all. Nothing. I could not. And the weird thing is, I mean, the reason I did it, I was reading like people would have kind of like miraculous anecdote. They would tell their experiences. They'd be like, holy cow, this made a big difference for me. You know, so I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to try that.
Yeah.
And it's not cheap. It was one of the more expensive protocols I did.
And you know, that's just exactly it. There's so many great things out there that do amazing things for us. But the problem is that they don't all work for everyone, you know, and that's the whole trial and error. And that could be one of the biggest frustrating parts, you know,
totally.
Like, you know, a lot of us, we're like, okay, we need this money. Where are we going to allocate this money? We don't know. There's no, you can have, you know, 5-star reviews, so to say, from all these products, but it may not work for you. And so that's just one of the many challenges of Lyme disease, unfortunately. Yeah. So, you know, and that's why I love doing this show, because we just talk about all the things, right? And and we want to know the cheap things, the expensive things, the things we can do at home that, you know, don't cost money, the dry brush, you know, just all the things. We just want to share it because that's what it's all about. We got to spread the awareness about what this is all about and how we can get better.
Yeah, I'm actually, I found about SOT from another patient while I was sitting in a doctor's office.
Exactly, right? Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, I was asking her, I was like, well, and I started realizing, I'm like, I got to pick the brains of every single patient I meet because I have to be my own advocate.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. I say those to all the time. We have to be our own advocate. And the quicker we can learn that, I think the quicker we can actually get better.
Yeah, the doctors are going to care about you while you're in their office. And then they're on to the next patient.
Yep. We're just a number to most of them. There are some really good, incredible doctors out there.
That's right.
But yeah, for most of them, we are just a number for sure. You know, it's our problem. So absolutely.
So Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I just was going to ask you. So that kind of summarized what, like 5 years of your journey? And
no,
and
that's about half of it.
Okay.
I did some other things. So,
okay, perfect.
Remember I was talking about the brain damage I got. I was thinking like, well, one of the things I studied was like, well, some people were having benefits from hyperbaric. And hyperbaric also is known to be good for traumatic brain injury. And I had a brain injury effectively because of the neuropathy. And I was like, well, maybe hyperbaric can kind of like deal with two things. It could maybe help my brain to heal, but maybe it can also help with the infections that it seems to be helping to some other patients with that. So I was like, I'll do hyperbaric. And I went the full distance in the sense I went to like a professional clinic that has like the big metal tank that they could do like 1.8 atmosphere mm-hmm. instead of the fabric tanks that I think go up to about 1.4 atmospheres. The reason 1.8 atmosphere is important is because if you talk to like an actual like trained professional that knows this science, you'll find that it takes 1.8 atmosphere in order for the plasma to be saturated with oxygen.
Okay.
It doesn't occur at lower pressures, my understanding of it. So, and by the way, disulfiram is contraindicated with hyperbaric. So it's like this really obscure fact, but it's relevant for Lyme people. So if you're on disulfiram, don't actually also do hyperbaric at the same time, because disulfiram blocks superoxygen dismutase. And superoxygen dismutase is something your body naturally makes to prevent your body from having oxygen toxicity.
Interesting. And I'm glad you brought that up. So also my research over the years, the HBOT, the hyperbaric and oxygen therapy, it's done amazing things for people, right? I've also heard that if it is not designed for people with Babesia.
Yeah, I think I've heard that too.
Did you? Yeah. And so again, yeah. You know, no medical advice there. I don't know. I'm not a doctor, but I've heard right. it over and over again that it's a great form of therapy. But if you have Babesia, that is not your option of choices. So
right.
And apparently with disulfiram as well.
Yeah, I did. So I did 58 dives.
Wow. Okay.
Which is a lot. And around that same time, right at that same time, I was concurrently doing intravenous ultraviolet ozone treatment.
Oh, I love that. One of my favorite things.
So I did 28 of those, okay. like kind of interleaving those while I was, like I do a session of hyperbaric and then I go to a session of UV ultraviolet IV session. You know, okay. I'm kind of staggering back mm-hmm. and forth between those. And by the way, when I had developed all those neurological issues, I did not initially develop the insomnia, but I was starting to like freak out because I was having all these problems occur, right? All these health problems that I was struggling to deal with. And so I think my anxiety levels about my health in general was just kind of amping up. And so in February, so this was like, you know, about 6 months after my symptoms all started, I stayed up. I pulled an all-nighter with my son to help him with the school project. And then the next morning, I'm like, well, I'm up. I might as well just stay up. I did not go to bed. That was a catastrophic mistake. I think my health was already compromised enough, and I already had kind of enough anxiety about my health in general that when I then messed with my circadian rhythm, and I used to sleep like a baby before that. I slept perfectly. I could nap anytime. It was just like flawless sleep, right? And it from that day forward, I developed horrific insomnia. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I started seeing all kinds of other doctors, like sleep experts and stuff, because I was not sleeping. And I mean, like no sleep, none. I would go multiple nights in a row, very frequently 2 to 5 nights in a row with not a second of sleep. Yeah. And then I would get a couple of nights where I would get maybe 2 hours or so. And it would go back to 0000223002.
And the struggle is real. I mean, I remember over my journey, and this sounds crazy, but it's the honest to goodness truth. Twice during my 13-year journey, I went 7 days with zero sleep, not 1 minute of sleep. Done. Couldn't do it. Twice.
Absolute seven. Torture.
Like we're already, you know, just a hot mess from having this Lyme. And then when you add lack of sleep, like it's a whole nother level of it. So yeah, sleep is a huge issue for us. And just people in general, I think, struggle with sleep, and it's so important.
10% of people have insomnia, and up to 30% of people have some kind of sleep disturbance issue. It's a huge
Yes. In fact, that's kind of low. That sounds kind of low to me. I would think there would be more for sure.
Okay. Well, those are the numbers I read.
You're probably right. I'm just saying I would have thought for sure a lot more because people struggle with sleep. It's a thing. So what was your ticket? What did you figure out?
And I just want to kind of emphasize how absolutely profound this was I did the sleep studies. I worked with multiple sleep specialists, including sleep specialist neurologists. You know, I did, so I was like doing everything I could from the conventional medicine side of things to try and find solutions to this. And they threw all the sleep drugs at me and I tried all the sleep drugs. And like, I did actually have temporary success with four of them, ketotifen, mirtazapine, quetiapine, and Qvivic, which is Adora. And all of those, all of them stopped working after a certain amount of time. Basically, that's the problem.
Yeah. Every year I got on a new sleep drug because it would quit working. And the doctor's like, well, we're out of sleep meds. So I was on like anti-seizure medication, but a side effect of it was sleep. So yeah, they eventually quit working. So we've got to find a solution to it.
It's so frustrating when you like, I remember twice, like for instance, with ketotifen, it worked for about 45 days. And I was like, sweet. I got my life back. Finally. Okay. So I started working again because I hadn't been working. I wasn't functional when I was not sleeping. During the period of insomnia went on for 4.5 years, and my doctors were having me log what was happening to me. So I logged around 480 nights without a second of sleep during that period of time. And when I did sleep, it was an average of 2 hours. Mm. So it was like incredible sleep deprivation. The worst was 12 nights. I went 12 nights without sleep one time. I was hallucinating. It's very strange because I started to experience my life in the third person. It's sort of psychologically, in order to handle the trauma, I was just kind of like not even there really. It's really, really weird. But the suffering was just unbelievable. And two times I went 9 nights. I can't even count how many times I went, like five, you know. It was just, that was like the regular. And so it was just horrific sleep for 4.5 years, right? Crippling, absolutely crippling. I was so exhausted that I couldn't even watch television because I could not maintain focus on television. So I was like catatonic, I would like stare at a wall. And I was conscious, but I don't really want to go into it too much because it's really hard for me to remember this. Like I start to kind of experience.
And I'm sure the listeners, I think you've given enough information. Like it's, the struggle is real. And most of it deal with this. Most of us deal with it for sure.
Yeah. So that's kind of like the severity of it. And then I just want to tell you like what solved this for me.
Yes, like I'm excited. Magic. Tell me.
Yeah. So I'm listening to, and by the way, I never gave up hope. You know, I just kept on trying everything. And I think that's important. It kind of touches on what you said earlier, like you got to just keep trying things, keep trying things. Don't give up hope. Just fight, you know, just fight for your life. It's worth it, you know? And so I'm listening to this podcast and it was a Huberman podcast. I don't know if you've heard of Andrew Huberman, but he's a professor of neurobiology and ophthalmology at Stanford School of Medicine. So that means he knows a ton about the brain and the eyes. And in this podcast, he was describing how in the 80s, they made this discovery that lateral eye motion, kind of like looking left and looking right, kind of in downward direction, I think, is that it suppresses the activity of the amygdala. And earlier you mentioned like how you're in this kind of fight and flight state. You're panicking, right? You start to freak out because all these things are going on. Well, I was in a major panicking state because I was never sleeping. I was freaking out because I wasn't sleeping. I had enormous anxiety about my sleep.
You know what? I would get anxiety just to think about crawling in bed because I already know I'm just going to lay there and not sleep.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I just started staying out on the couch.
Yeah.
Like because your bed it lessened. A yes, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. It's like a torture chamber.
Yep.
Yeah. So anyway, he described how like they found that lateral eye motion suppresses the activity of the amygdala. That's the kind of primitive monkey part of your brain where anxiety and fear and fight and flight is processed. And it's not something that you kind of like, it's not part of your cortex. It's not part of your rational thinking. It's like really primitive brain stuff.
Okay.
And they discovered it was so effective, they started to incorporate it into therapeutic techniques to treat anxiety and PTSD generally. Now, Huberman didn't discuss this in the context of insomnia, but like at that night, it was 2:30 in the morning, actually. I'm lying there, of course, wide awake, and I'm thinking about this podcast. I'm like, you know, I'm pretty sure I have serious anxiety about my sleep. what if I just do this lateral eye motion while I'm lying here in bed? And I had my eyes closed, okay? And by the way, just a little bit of background on this. My understanding is that the theory behind why this is affected may be that because when we're walking forward, we're kind of unconsciously scanning the ground in front of us. And when we're in danger, we're not kind of like just strolling forward anymore. When we're in danger, we stop or we're fighting or we're running. But we're definitely not scanning the ground anymore. Okay. And so the idea is, the theory is, I think, that this lateral emotion sends a really kind of fundamental kind of signal to your primitive brain that, hey, we're okay, everything's safe.
Okay.
And so, and by the way, when they incorporated it into a therapeutic technique for treatment of anxiety and PTSD, what they would do is they would intentionally bring to mind the trigger of the anxiety or PTSD, and then they would do this kind of lateral eye motion or some similar type of action, and that in order to retrain the brain that trigger was no longer dangerous, that was safe. Well, here I am lying in my trigger, right? I'm in bed. So, and so I have my eyes closed and I just kind of was looking downward, and I would look left and right, like about this fast, towards my left earlobe, towards my right earlobe, just kind of going back and forth like that. And I did about like, and I might linger just a little bit at the ends. And I did about maybe 8 or 9 passes like this. And then I just waited and just relaxed, just kind of, you know, felt how my bed is comfortable and just let my mind wander randomly, which is because sleep is involuntary. You can't force sleep. So you need to just let your mind be random. And then a little while later, as I realized, well, I'm still awake, then I did another set back and forth, maybe 8 or 9 of these things. And I had my eyes closed again still. And the next thing I know, I was waking up in the morning and I had fallen asleep. And I got maybe 3 hours of sleep, which is like, that's actually like at the time.
That's pretty good for you at the time.
Yeah, that was good. Like, you know, I could limp along that day. I wasn't like in zero is where you really suffer, right? So,
yeah.
So I'm like, oh, and in my mind, I was like, well, that could be a fluke, but it does no harm whatsoever to just do this
right.
And more.
Yeah.
And so then I was like, because that very first night I had only kind of thought of the idea at 2:30 in the morning. I'm like, well, I'm just going to start every night like this. And during the night, as I find myself awake, I'll just do sets of these lateral eye motions.
Okay.
And from that night on, that was like absolute turning point. In fact, I have a spreadsheet. Like I said, I've been tracking my sleep, and I can show like in my spreadsheet, it's like, you know, it's like the horrific sleep. And then boom, it just like, elbows right
that
there.
It
just incredible change in the sleep patterns.
So you don't even have to have your eyes open. They can just be closed and on, you know, behind your eyelids, you're just scanning your eyes from left to right.
Mm-hmm.
Back about like 7-8 passes.
Yeah.
And then just kind of rest your mind.
You can experiment with it yourself and see kind of what kind of makes you feel more calm. You might like linger longer at the ends. I don't strain my eyes though. That's one thing. I don't ever like really try and get hard left and hard right. I don't strain at all. I'm just kind of gently scanning back and forth.
Okay.
And some nights I might do 20 sets of these things and I'm still doing them. My sleep is still fragmented because, you know, hey, I went for years and years with horrible, horrible sleep.
But for the most part, it always works for you.
It's consistent now. I've only had like maybe 1-0 a month now for like the past 9 months.
Wow.
So this was about 9 months ago I started this. And it's been
and it's
just been
free and it's easy and
no
right?
Yeah.
You have nothing to lose. So all these listeners tonight, when you crawl in bed, like this is what we're gonna do, right?
Yeah. The crazy thing to me is like I tried so many things that are like, oh gosh, you know, all these drugs, you read the side effects warnings and they're like psychosis, death, da da da. Yeah. You're like,
can I get 2, please?
How about I just look left and right, you know?
Yeah, but you know, and that's the great thing about this podcast is, you know, we are our own advocate. So we're out there learning of all these different things, and something as simple as looking left and right, like who would have thought and had I not discovered you, I never would have heard this, right? Like, so that's why we got to share these things that work for us and may not work for you, but I certainly, it's free. It doesn't cost anything. You don't have to swallow a pill. You don't have to taste a nasty tincture, right? Just move them eyes. So I'm all in.
Yeah, I'm still kind of blown away. Like, I'm like, wow, this is so simple. It's just so simple. Like, how can this be so consistently effective? It's mind boggling to me that this is such an effective thing that, like, holy cow, it really does work. Now, one thing I have noticed is that if I sabotage myself by having bad sleep hygiene, then I'll have bad sleep. Like, this is not good enough to cut through that.
Okay.
So I have to do my part as well.
Right. And I think that's a good point too, because we have to, you know, our bodies are designed to heal themselves. Right. But you have to give it the proper tools, you know, and you've got to find these tools that work for you. And so, yes, we need to have, you know, good nutrition. You need to, it's so important to go to bed at the same time, you know,
very, very important.
Sleep in a cool room, you know, like all the things. Yep. So you can't just, you know, you can't eat a salad one day and be like, go check on the scale. Did I lose 10 pounds? You know, I ate a salad today. Like, but that's a lot of times the mentality that people have. And especially when we go through a journey like this, because it's hard, it messes with our brain and our emotions, and we don't think clearly, and you know, so it's just a struggle. But yes, everything in moderation, right? Like, we always hear that. And then we got to throw just different tools at things.
Yeah, those things that you mentioned, like going to bed a consistent hour. So these are critical parts of sleep hygiene, having good sleep hygiene, not sabotaging your sleep. Yep. There's and having a cool room is typically recommended as well. There's like a number of things. I've actually, I put a website out there. It's drugfreesleep.org. It's non-commercial, and it lists all these good sleep hygiene practices that you should do to help to maintain good sleep or encourage your body to move in that direction. And then also describes this whole lateral eye motion thing and how I came about that. So if you have questions about that, you can kind of refer to that.
Oh, that's fabulous. So we will definitely put that website on the title of your podcast so people can find that. And that's great. And just check it out. You know, like, we think we know most of these things, but sometimes we forget things. Sometimes we need just the simplest reminder of, well, gosh, I wasn't doing that, you know. Shoot, why did I quit doing that? Maybe that's, you know, part of my ticket. So so we're definitely going to share that website with that information. And I'm excited, you know, my sleep has been good. I can't really complain. But, hey, I'll tell you what, I'm excited to crawl in bed tonight because I'm going to do it for sure. Like, what do I got to lose, right? So I hope all the listeners out there are going to do it too. Post a review. Let us know if it worked for you, right?
Yeah, definitely. I'm really interested in hearing that. I've actually heard back from quite a few people I've told this about. And like, they come back to the same thing. They're like, oh my gosh, I cannot believe this. Like, I want to take you out for dinner. Thank you so much.
You might be everyone's hero, Nathan, for sure.
Well, I didn't invent this thing. I just kind of like thought, oh, hey, insomniacs have anxiety. By the way, when you go on the sleep forums online, you will notice like a huge majority of the people will literally say, I have so much anxiety about my sleep. I'm freaking out, right? And I think that like what happens is that the anxiety then causes the insomnia.
It works against us.
Yeah, it could be something else that initially like triggers it, like you end up with a bad night. But then if you're kind of like in a state where you're kind of anxious about your health or you're anxious about your sleep, then you can start to get that entrenched. And then the insomnia itself perpetuates that vicious cycle. So you have to find a way.
It's mindset. I talk so much about mindset. You kind of are what you think. Right. Like, totally. So don't, and I know it's easier said than done. Right. Like, we know but don't have that anxiety. Like, be excited to crawl in your bed and do this lateral eye movement or whatever it is that you do that works for you. But get that anxiety out of your mind, because all it does is works against you. And like I said, easier said than done for sure. But these are just things that we work on in practice. Right. We're all a work in progress.
There's, by the way, two other gems that I found that are simple but crazy effective. Would you be interested in knowing
about those? We got just a couple minutes, so we will wrap it up with that for sure.
Just real fast then. One of them is apple cider vinegar. And so when you have prolonged sleep deprivation, it messes with your glucose levels and you start to develop insulin resistance, which I developed. So I was headed towards type 2 diabetes. And then, you know, I've seen all these studies where they're talking about how like acetic acid, like, you know, it was just like apple cider vinegar has a lot of acetic acid in it, and how it would like dampen the glucose response, it would just bring your glucose levels down when you're taking carbs. And I'm like, well, okay, I'll try that. And so I was wearing a continuous glucose monitor. It's a permanent device that you wear. So I was doing that for 2 straight months, and it's tied to an app, so I could see my glucose levels all the time. And I could see immediately what was happening when I would eat. And the crazy thing for me was that when I started doing apple cider vinegar, what I'd do is in the morning, I would do a tablespoon of apple cider vinegar, and I'd also squeeze in half a lemon actually too. And then I would use a glass straw to suck that to the back of my mouth so it would bypass all the enamel, because you don't want that, all that acid on your teeth.
Oh, good point. Yes,
and,
yes.
And then I'd use a glass straw because it's inert. And then I would, after that, I would then chase it with just a straight glass of water just to make sure there's no acid in my mouth. And what happened is that, and I would do that an hour before I ate. And sometimes if I had a little bit more carbs at the meal, I would also do some apple cider vinegar with the meal. And it was like, when I started doing the apple cider vinegar like that, it was like being a different person metabolically. Like you wouldn't recognize the chart, that the glucose monitor chart looked like a totally different human. Yeah. And so like this stuff is crazy effective. So that was one of the other jams I discovered. And then the final one was low dose naltrexone, which I'm sure you've probably encountered.
Yep, heard a lot about it. Yep.
Yeah, that was I had so one of the autoimmune issues I developed I developed rheumatoid arthritis, Hashimoto's, PANS, and Hashimoto's is hypothyroidism, which your thyroid is being attacked, and then rheumatoid arthritis is a form of arthritis that's autoimmune in nature. So there's a lab, it's the RA factor lab, and if you have elevated RA factor, it basically means your immune system's attacking your joints. And I had visibly swollen, red, excruciatingly painful joints that would, like, they just never stopped hurting. And with low-dose naltrexone, when you take low-dose naltrexone, the conventional wisdom is you start out at a very low dose, like 0.5 milligram per day, and you very gradually titrate up until you find the dose at which you get a beneficial response, and that's your target dose. For almost everyone, the magic number is 4.5 milligram, and that was what it turned out to be for me, because I started out at 0.5, I gradually increased my dose over time, and when I hit 4.5 milligram, all of my rheumatoid arthritis symptoms vanished 100%. And not only that, but over time, my RA factor lab values came down to low normal range, which basically means it put my arthritis into remission.
Wow. That one drug. Wow. Yeah. Fabulous. So, absolutely fabulous. Well, yeah. Nathan, oh my gosh, like this has just been jam packed full of so many great tips and expensive and or free tips, right? So,
yeah.
Wow. Thank you so, so much for taking the time to join me and just chat and share all the things that worked for you. And hopefully the listeners can take bits and pieces from what worked for you, and maybe it'll be their ticket too. So
yeah,
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Good luck to everybody.
I sure hope you listeners enjoyed that episode. Whether it's hope you needed, a little inspiration today, or just maybe some validation that what you're feeling, what you're going through is real. Maybe you needed tips on how to treat at home, ideas, thoughts, detoxing, whatever it is. I truly just hope it's what you got out of today's episode. That is my only hope, is just to give back to this community in any way possible. If you would like to help me get your voice heard and spread this podcast, please go to the Patreon link in the description, and any donation is welcome, just simply to help cover the studio costs.